Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Nehemiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 73. That sounds like a lot of verses, but most of it's a genealogy. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we see a conspiracy by the rulers of the provinces west of the Euphrates, who tried to sabotage Nehemiah in the eyes of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. They failed. Chapter 5, that was chapter 6. Chapter 5, Nehemiah has helped the poor out with his personal contributions. He was obviously a wealthy man. Chapter 4, we see opposition to the wall as it was being built. Now, the wall is already up now by the time we get to chapter 7, except for the doors, the gates. But by the time this chapter is over, the gates will be finished and everything will be done. So we start now with Nehemiah 7, verses 1 and 2. Now, when the wall was rebuilt and I had set up the doors, and the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed, then I put Hanani, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem. For he, I'm assuming that's Hanani, not Hananiah, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Now, gatekeepers were appointed in verse 1. Now, if these gatekeepers were Levites, it doesn't say that they were. It implies that they were. Well, then their duties would be to watch over the temple and to open and close the gates of the temple courts. However, those gatekeepers might not have been temple gatekeepers. They might have been gatekeepers for the wall, and they might have been Levites, or they might not have been Levites, depending on how you read verse 1. If they were Levites, then the Levites were to return to their service in the temple as keepers of the gates of the temple. They had been busy working on the wall, as we see in Nehemiah 3:17. After him, the Levites carried out repairs under Rehum, the son of Bani. But I think it's easier just to say the gatekeepers were for the wall, because that's what the context of this chapter is. In fact, Cambridge commentator says that it's the gates of the wall, not the temple, that's being referred to here by Nehemiah. Now, Hanani is Nehemiah's brother. Again, brother could mean Jewish brother. It could be first cousin. It could be close friend. I'm not exactly sure, but assuming it's his blood brother, let's just assume that. At any rate, whoever he was in relation to Nehemiah, he was the same Hanani who had told Nehemiah about the sad plight of Jerusalem and its walls a couple of months earlier when Nehemiah was in Susa. Hanani had left Jerusalem and had traveled all the way to Susa, the capital city of Persia, to tell Nehemiah about the sad state of the walls. That's a, what, 4 or 5 month journey. It's a long way. We read that in Nehemiah 1:2, then Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. Now, John Gill says that Hanani's long journey from Jerusalem to Susa is proof of his character, and his character is stated here in verse 2. He was a faithful man and feared God more than many, assuming some unclear antecedent for the he. It could be Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, but again, I'm assuming it's Hanani, the brother of Nehemiah. Now, Hanani is put in charge of Jerusalem, and Hanani is put in charge of Jerusalem. Now, many say that the reason he's putting these two men in charge of Jerusalem is because Nehemiah is returning to Persia, as he had promised Artaxerxes when Artaxerxes gave him permission to go to Jerusalem. We read in Nehemiah 2:6, then the king, that's Artaxerxes, said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. But now it's controverted whether Nehemiah actually returned shortly after arriving. We know he returned after 12 years, but the question is did he go examine the situation, get the walls built in 52 days, and then turn back to Susa and go back to Persia, and then King Artaxerxes then sent him back to Jerusalem? It's not really clear, but this verse does sound like he returned after finishing the walls to Susa. Nehemiah 1:2, I gave him a definite time. Excuse me, Nehemiah 2:6, it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. It sounds like he was intending to return. And here in Nehemiah 7, Nehemiah puts Hanani and Hananiah in charge of Jerusalem, which sounds like he's leaving. So from inference, we can, and a lot of commentators do, suspect that Nehemiah returned to Persia after building the walls and then came back to Jerusalem. Now, what is this fortress that Hananiah is in charge of? The NIV has citadel. Colin Dillett says, quote, This citadel was, quote, a fortress or citadel of the city lying to the north of the temple, in which was probably located the royal garrison, the commander of which was in the service of the Persian king. Well, every city had a garrison and had a citadel. So this is probably what this is referring to. There's a reference to this fortress in Nehemiah 2:8. Nehemiah is talking to the king, Artaxerxes, and let me have a letter written to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to rebuild the gates of the temple's fortress. And the king granted his request. We go now to Nehemiah 7, verses 3 through 4. I, Nehemiah, said to Hananiah, Hanani and Hananiah, the two that he had left in charge of Jerusalem, Nehemiah says to those two, do not open the gates of Jerusalem until the sun is hot, and let the doors be shut and securely fastened while the guards are on duty. Station the citizens of Jerusalem as guards, some at their post and some at their homes. The city was large and spacious, but there were few people in it, and no houses had been built yet. Now, of course, the walls of a city always closed at night to keep attackers out. Nehemiah is saying, don't open those gates up early in the morning. Wait until the sun is hot. Now, why would he do that? Well, John Gill speculates that by then, enemies lying in wait would have to move from their positions because of the heat and thus be discovered by the defenders. Well, even without the heat, advancing sunlight would expose the attacker's position. If you open the gates at dawn to let people go out to farm and so forth, dawn is still fairly dark and it would be easier to attack the city. So Nehemiah is very careful here. He says, keep the gates shut until the sun is high. And then he says, and let the doors, that means the gates to the wall, be shut and securely fastened while the guards are on duty. Now what I'm assuming at nighttime now when the doors are shut, because that's at nighttime, let them be securely fastened while the guards are on duty. In other words, at the end of the day, when it's time to shut the doors, make sure you've got guards on duty so that the people shutting the gates will not be surprised by a surprise attack. Now, at the end of verse 3, Nehemiah tells Hanani and Hananiah, station the citizens of Jerusalem as guards, some at their post, I assume that's on the wall where they could see, and some citizens of Jerusalem as guards at their homes. And again, I assume that that is homes that are built into the wall. And so that would be a logical place to put a guard. Now notice that there are no foreigners in these guards, citizens of Jerusalem, people at their homes. Because it was their home, each guard had a personal interest to keep a good watch, as John Gill says. And again, Nehemiah has thought of everything down to the last detail. He was a fantastic governor, taking care of military opposition, organizing things, encouraging people to do their duty and to build a wall and so forth, taking care of finances, as we'll see. Now, verse 4 in Nehemiah 7 says the city was large and spacious, Jerusalem was, but there were few people in it and no houses had been built yet. That means inside the wall, but on the wall there were houses built, as we saw in the chapter 3, when the walls were built, we saw that some houses were actually built inside the walls. The back part of the house was the wall itself. John Gill points this out. Adam Clark says that there were a row of houses all around the inside of the wall. Now, why were there so few people in the city? Well, because Jerusalem used to be a big city before it got burnt down by the Babylonians in 586 B.C., and the number of the exiles, 43,000, that would include people going out into the countryside as well as into Jerusalem. So the city was kind of a ghost of its former self. The Babylonian exile had decimated the population of Jerusalem, and we know that there were a lot of Jews that stayed behind in Babylon and that did not come back to Jerusalem. So you had Jerusalem's population decimated by the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, and then the exile decimated them even further because the amount of returnees from Babylon did not include 100% of the rump that was there in Babylon. And so the city was kind of vacant. Nehemiah 7:5, then my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled by genealogies. Then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first, in which I found the following record. Notice Nehemiah in verse 5 gives God the credit for instigating him to assemble the nobles and the officials and the people so that they could enroll themselves by genealogy, so they could take a census, basically. Any good thing Nehemiah did, he ascribed to God. He was a godly, pious man. My God put it in my heart to do this. Now, Nehemiah enrolled all the people. And then, he says, he found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first. That would be Ezra's genealogy. And we're going to look briefly at that book of the genealogy in just a minute. But let's look at why Nehemiah enrolled the people by genealogies. The NIV Study Bible states that the reasons were various. First of all, the leadership had shifted from city rulers of Jerusalem to traditional heads of family clans because of this genealogy that's being taken. The NIV Study Bible says another reason for enrolling the people in genealogies is that key leaders are named for Jerusalem to restore it to credibility as a capital city. And the third reason that the officials and nobles were enrolled in a genealogy was so that impurity in the priesthood would be cleaned out. Now it could be known who was of the family of Aaron or not, so that the priests would be legitimate when they served in the temple. We read that in the midst of the genealogy in Nehemiah 7, 64 through 65 in this same chapter. These searched, talking about family of Aaron people, Aaronites, these searched for their entries in the genealogical records, but they could not be found. So they were disqualified from the priesthood. So I guess I should say purported members of the family of Aaron searched for their names, couldn't find them. 65, the governor ordered them not to eat the most holy things until there was a priest who could consult the Urim and Thummim. In other words, they're going to find a priest who can use the Urim and Thummim, which was probably, let's just say, a white rock and a black rock. Nobody knows exactly what it was, but the idea is you pull one item out of the breastplate of the high priest, and by golly, it's yes, this person is of the family of Aaron. Oh, he got a black stone. This person is not of the family of Aaron. And of course, that would assume that there was not just a high priest who would use the Urim and Thummim. Fourth reason for this enrollment into genealogies, as the NIV Study Bible says, is that a new national identity was established thereby. The people now had roots. They knew where they were from. The fifth reason for the genealogy was that funds were to be raised to rebuild Jerusalem. Whenever a government takes your name and puts it on a list, it's either to tax you or to send you into the army to get you shot at. So that's the bad news. Well, those are five reasons the NIV Study Bible gave. John Gill gives another reason. Now the Israelites could know which family from which the Messiah was to be sprung. The Old Testament prophecy said Judah, and now we'll know who's in the family of Judah. Well, that all makes sense. Now, in the process of enrolling the nobles and the officials and the people by genealogies, Nehemiah found the original genealogy that Ezra had drawn up. And this book of Ezra, this genealogy of Ezra, he reproduces for us here at the end of chapter 7. Now, there are slight differences between the two genealogies. It's the same genealogy, but as reported in Ezra, it's slightly different than as it is reported in Nehemiah. So how do we account for the discrepancies? Well, let's look at some of the merely apparent differences. John Gill says that there was a Jewish custom of calling the same person by different names, and that could account for some of the differences. John Gill says that some names would refer to the same people, but they might have been pronounced differently, and thus they show up differently in the two accounts of the genealogy, Ezra's genealogy. Or John Gill says that maybe the copyist who copied the genealogy could have made a mistake, as the genealogy is copied from Ezra to Nehemiah. Well, those would not really be differences. Those are just apparent differences, as I said. But it could be that there were some substantive differences between the two genealogies as reported by Ezra and as reported by Nehemiah. Well, how can we account for the very few discrepancies that arise this way? Substantive discrepancies, different people. Well, as John Gill points out, Ezra drew up his list while Ezra was in Babylon, and then when Ezra got to Jerusalem, the list could have changed. As the Benson commentary says, some could have died after they got to Jerusalem, or some could have been enrolled in the original genealogy and then changed their minds and not come, and so they had to adjust the genealogy afterwards when Ezra got to Jerusalem. But the original genealogy as recorded in Ezra would be the one that was drawn up originally and had not been changed yet. Or it could be that people who were not put in Ezra's genealogy at first as those planning to come, some could have changed their minds and say, yes, on second thought, we are going to go back to Jerusalem, and Ezra had not had time to update the list of people that had come. Benson suggests another possible idea. The returning exiles could not at first prove who their family was, and so they were not included in Ezra's original genealogy, which was drawn up in Babylon. But when they got to Jerusalem, and as time went on, they searched their family records and so forth, now we know what family we're in, so Ezra, please update the genealogy. We go down to Nehemiah 7, verses 6 and 7. These are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. That, of course, was in 586 BC at the destruction of Jerusalem and the capture of Israel. These exiles, continuing with verse 6, these exiles who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city, who came with Zerubbabel, a Jeshua. Now, of course, Zerubbabel was the first civil governor of Israel, or Judah. I keep calling Judah Israel because there is no more northern Israel anymore. The 10 tribes have been dispersed, and so all that's left is Judah. So we can call it Judah. We can call it Israel. But Zerubbabel was governor of Judah. Jeshua, also known as Joshua, was the high priest, the first high priest in Jerusalem after the return. And then Nehemiah, that's, of course, probably our famous Nehemiah, the author of this book, or I say the author of this book, the subject of this book. Many people say that Ezra wrote this book. Nehemiah just took care of the genealogies and such. And then Mordecai is listed in verse 7. That is only remotely possible that this was Esther's cousin. Most people think he was not Esther's cousin, this particular Mordecai, according to the NIV Study Bible. Now, in Nehemiah 7, verses 8 through 69, we have a bunch of men's names with numbers by the names to tell how many people came. Now, of course, I'm not going to read all those things to you. That would drive both you and me insane. But I will pick out something interesting in this genealogy. In verse 57, we read this, the sons of Solomon's servants, and then names are listed. Well, who are the sons of Solomon's servants? Servants can be slaves. Now, I lost the site to which commentator said this, but whoever he was said this, these people weren't likely descended simply from Solomon's court servants. More likely, this refers to Canaanite people Solomon had forced into slavery and who had eventually become part of the Israelite nation. Well, that's reasonable, but there's another option. This is interesting. This is from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to summarize it at the end. Quote, the children of Solomon's servants, again, this is the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, ISBE. The children of Solomon's servants constitute a company or guild of the Jewish exiles who returned with Zerubbabel from Babylonia to Jerusalem in 537, actually it's 538 BC, pursuant to the decree of Cyrus. They are mentioned five times, twice in Ezra, three times in Nehemiah. As the prime purpose of the returning exiles was the rebuilding of the temple and the restoration of Yahweh's worship, it was important that those who held the privileges of sanctuary service as a family heritage should go back to their duties. This included, besides priests and Levites, the Nethinim. Those were temple servants, sometimes translated as temple servants. The Nethinim helped the Levites. So besides priests and Levites and the Nethinim, Solomon's servants. Capital S, capital S. So ISBE takes Solomon's servants as a special class of people. Continuing, in every reference to them, Solomon's servants are connected with the Nethinim, who had been given or dedicated by David for the service of the Levites. In other words, the Nethinim helped out the Levites, and the Levites, of course, helped out the priest. So Solomon's servants trace their official beginning back to Solomon's appointment, as their name indicates. In the joint references, they always fall into the natural chronological order, i.e. following the Nethinim. In other words, David appointed the Nethinim, Solomon followed David, Solomon appointed Solomon's servants. It is possible, therefore, that they are referred to in Ezra 7:24 also under the title Servants of this House of God, which immediately follows Nethinim in the list of those exempt from taxation and tolls. What their duties in the House of God may have been is not stated in the records. These must have been more or less menial, the more formal and honorable duties being reserved for the priests and Levites, the singers and porters, doorkeepers. When the ark was brought to Jerusalem by David and the ceremonial of the sacrificial system was more strictly observed, the services of priests and Levites were greatly increased, and to meet the needs of the new order, David appointed the Nethinim. Likewise, the much greater increase in such duties on the completion of Solomon's temple was the occasion for the dedication of an additional number of these assistants to the Levites. So we can look at it this way. The Levites helped the priest when the tabernacle was coming through the wilderness, and when it was established before the monarchy in Canaan. And then David established the Levitical order of sacrifice more strictly. David didn't have a temple, but he had, well, actually he had two tabernacles. He had the tabernacle at Gibeon, and he had another tabernacle in Jerusalem. But he set up the sacrifices, and that's going to require more work, so he appoints the Nethinim, the temple servants, to help the Levites. And now, after you get past David, you have this huge temple built by Solomon, and the Nethinim weren't enough to help the Levites. And so then Solomon's servants, capital S, are added to help out the Nethinim. Interesting speculations there. There is a dispute about whether these Solomon's servants were Levites or non-Levites. They probably were Levites. We get down to verse 66, and we see that the total number in this genealogy of Ezra, as quoted by Nehemiah, is 42,360. The problem is when you add the numbers up, you get different numbers. Now, if you go back to the book of Ezra and add up the numbers in the genealogy, you get 29,818. This is the NIV Study Bible's numbers. If you come here in this genealogy in Nehemiah and add the numbers up, you get 31,089, which is, of course, different than 29,818. Now, the NIV Study Bible presumes that those lower numbers can be accounted for because the larger number includes men, women, and children. But the list here in Ezra and Nehemiah only include the men. And since both genealogies add up to the same number, 42,360, we can presume that the numbers are accurate and they include men, women, and children. We go now to verses 70 to 73 and we will finish this audio. Some from among the heads of fathers' households gave to the work. The governor gave to the treasury 1,000 gold drachmas, 50 basins, 530 priest garments. Some of the heads of fathers' households gave into the treasury of the work 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,200 silver minas. That which the rest of the people gave was 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,000 silver minas and 67 priest garments. Well, that's just a bunch of money. It's interesting. I think about churches who like to say, this is how much so-and-so gave, and they put their name up on the front of the room, which to me is disgusting. They didn't seem to have a problem with it, though, back here. Well, they didn't list people out individually. They just gave the aggregate amounts, which I guess is okay. It says the governor gave 1,000 gold drachmas. 1,000 gold drachmas, according to the NIV note, is about 19 pounds. The governor, of course, well, I say of course, is probably Nehemiah. Some people say that the governor is unknown for sure. John Gill says whether this governor was Zerubbabel or Nehemiah is not easy to say. Remember, this is a genealogy drawn up in the time of Ezra and reported by Nehemiah, so it could have been Zerubbabel who gave all that money. But remember, Nehemiah is a wealthy man, as we pointed out several times going through here, so I wouldn't be surprised if it was Nehemiah. I'm not going to go through all these gold and silver donations except to give you a feel. 20,000 gold drachmas, that's about 375 pounds of gold. That's a good bit. 2,200 silver minas, that's about 1 1/3 tons of silver. That's a good bit. 67 priestly garments. Now, one might ask, why so many priestly garments given to the temple? Well, the Jews had been long in Babylon. They hadn't used any priestly garments in Babylon because there was no temple. And so when the priests came back to Jerusalem, they didn't have any priestly garments to officiate with, and so people donated them. Verse 73 says, now the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people, the temple servants, and all Israel lived in their cities. Now the Levites, of course, who were gatekeepers and singers in the temple and gatekeepers in the temple and so forth, and the temple servants, that's the Nethinim, who worked in Jerusalem. They worked at Jerusalem, but they lived around Jerusalem in their cities. And so I'm assuming, of course, they came up in their courses on their alternate periods of duty. The seventh month, of course, is Tishri. The seventh religious month is Tishri. That's September and October. The walls had been finished in the previous month, in the sixth month. In Nehemiah 6:15, we read this. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. Elul is August, September, previous month. So you see, Nehemiah's not messing around. He came to Jerusalem. He got the wall built. He took the genealogy, accounted for all the money. And then some people say he goes back to Artaxerxes in Susa in Persia and says and tells Artaxerxes, I got the job done. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. So the register is complete. The genealogy is complete. There are no complaints recorded. Of course, Nehemiah recorded almost everybody who complained against him, as we've seen in the previous chapters, but no complaints here because he was precise, he was detailed, he was accurate, and we are now finished chapter 7 and prepared for our next audio to go to Nehemiah 8, 1 through 18. In Nehemiah 8, we're going to see some activity of Ezra, not Nehemiah, but Ezra as he reads the law to the people. So I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.